Reporter and author Elliot Ackerman says war is too serious to take it seriously all the time. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, October 1st. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we bring you Lori Walsh's conversation with war reporter Elliot Ackerman. They spoke at the South Dakota Festival of Books in Spearfish last week. His new book, Sheepdogs, is a thrilling tale of a heist concerning national security. But it's also a romp, because sometimes the most high-stakes situations require a bit of fun. We spend the hour exploring military culture, PTSD, and belonging and betrayal. We'll talk about Ackerman's experiences over his 5 tours of duty as a Marine overseas, and how that shapes his writing today. For broadcasting from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls, I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. Elliot Ackerman is a New York Times bestselling author. He is also a journalist and a Marine veteran who served for 5 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. He is a prolific author of both fiction and nonfiction. His latest book is Sheepdogs. It's a thriller about secrets and spies, military culture, and betrayal. Ackerman joined Lori Walsh at the South Dakota Festival of Books last week. We're bringing you that conversation now.
Sheepdogs was such a surprise to me because the work that you've done in the past is quite serious, and you've had some memoirs, combat memoirs. A lot of the interviews you've done have been about global affairs. A lot of your writing is thoughtful and forward-thinking. Sometimes right before something happens nationally, I'll read an essay of yours that says, this is about to happen nationally. So it feels like you're on the forward edge of thinking about national security issues. And then this book is incredibly smart and thrilling and funny at the same time. And it starts with identity and naming. So we meet these characters because they have real names, pseudonyms, and aliases. And it's all about identity in the beginning. Help us understand why the characters in your book have 3 different options for how they will be called.
Yeah, sure. So Sheepdogs is, I think, my 9th book. My prior books, I've written 2 memoirs. The rest were all novels. And as you correctly noted, they're all pretty serious. I guess they're pretty po-faced, geopolitical thrillers, some literary novels about the war, and memoirs that incorporate a lot of war reporting I've done in places like Syria and in Ukraine. And in all that time, sort of what escaped me in my writing was the truism, like, I'm a funny guy. Like, you have to be a funny guy if you're going to survive cruising around places like that. Because, I mean, as human beings, right, why we use humor as a coping mechanism. And so often my experience has been that war is too serious to take it seriously all the time. And, you know, we're both Marines. So we know whenever you get particularly Marines or service members or people who are journalists who are close to war, when you get us all together, like, we always start cutting up and we tell the funny stories. You know, we don't really tell the sad stories. So, right, fundamentally, I'm a storyteller. And I felt that in all these books, I've been leaving a lot on the cutting room floor. And so Sheepdogs is this sort of geopolitical romp. It's a heist book. So when the book opens, you meet these 2 guys. One is a former Marine special operator and CIA officer, much like me, and his nickname is Squirrel, because he's a guy who can get you anything, like a squirrel. But he spells it S-K-W-E-R-L. Why? Well, because Marines win wars not spelling bees. We're not that great at spelling. So everybody calls him a squirrel. And the other guy we meet is, his name is Aziz Iqbal. He is the greatest fighter pilot Afghanistan has ever produced. And his nickname, or his call sign when he was in the Afghan Air Force, was the Big Cheese Aziz, because he was the big cheese of being a fighter pilot. But when we meet him, you know, the Kabul has fallen. He and his family have escaped to the United States. And he's not flying jets like Maverick. He's working the midnight shift at a gas station. And that's what's befallen him, you know, wishing he could fly again. So basically, Squirrel kind of enlists Cheese into this scheme to repossess a private jet. And they become international repo men, which is actually a job. And the economics of that job are you're awarded a percentage of whatever you repossess. So they basically are offered 5% of the fee of this jet. And to what you said, Lori, the novel opens just sort of with this description of how the CIA does naming conventions, which is true. Mm-hmm. And I think the first line in the book is, you know, everybody in the office winds up with at least four names. And, you know, one is your actual name, your birth name. One is your pseudonym, which if you're undercover, internal emails, you actually just give you a pseudonym, because if you didn't have this pseudonym, every email you would write as an undercover officer would actually be classified because it could reveal your identity. So if I want to ask you out for lunch or something, mm-hmm. That would be a classified email if I didn't have my pseudonym. The next is your alias, which would be like if you traveled, what's on your fake passports. But the last name you get is your nickname, what everybody kind of calls you by, like how they call Squirrel, Squirrel. And in that world, I had my nickname. It was very nickname-y culture. But to me, you know, I wanted to start the book that way because it introduces, you know, one of the themes that exists in the book. I mean, it's a fun book, but there are some serious themes in it. And those themes are how important naming is, how important it is, the names we call things by, the words that we use, to particularly around conflict, you know, whether, you know, we saw most recently the debate on whether it's the Department of Defense or the Department of War. Why does that matter? Because actually it does matter what we name things. And the last name I'll mention in the book is the name Sheepdog. So when Squirrel and Cheese, you know, go off on this mission to repossess this luxury jet, they work for this, they're working on behalf of this sort of shadowy figure named Sheepdog, who sent Squirrel an anonymous email telling him that, you know, if he goes to X point, he'll be met by this person who will lead him to the jet. And his name is Sheepdog because some of you might be familiar with this because it is a military trope, but it's this idea that the world is divided up into really three types of people. There are sheep, and sheep are those who exist in the world believing that the violence that's out there, you know, can't really harm them, that they're safe. There are wolves. Wolves have an understanding of violence, and they use that violence to prey on sheep. So, you know, if you look at the world today, I think like probably Vladimir Putin would be a great example of a wolf. Mm-hmm. And then there are the sheepdogs, and the sheepdogs also understand violence, but they use their understanding of violence to protect the sheep from the wolves. So Sheepdog, whoever he, she, it is, gives Squirrel and Cheese their tasking. They go for the jet, and lots of hijinks ensue.
I have to ask you what your nickname was.
Oh, geez. My last name is Ackerman, so that's part of it. I was in the Raiders, our special operations unit, and we were having a team party, and I was kind of dancing like this, kind of like a white guy. And so Ackerman plus my dance moves, everybody called me Cracker.
And it's incredibly important that you did not give yourself a name.
That's very important,
you cannot,
too.
This is something that lands on you, and it sticks, and that's a big part of the beginning, because there's a character who decides that he's going to try to give himself a name, and this is a literary device in some ways to help us remember this character throughout the book, because he's not a main character, but he becomes incredibly essential later.
Yeah, he's very important. So in the book, am I allowed to say his nickname on the show?
Yep.
It's a little bit, okay. I just want to make sure I'm not getting in trouble by the authorities. So, yeah, so when the book opens, you know, we meet Squirrel, and one of the guys on his team is a young Marine, you know, kind of, you know, full of chutzpah and brio, and he shows up as the new guy on the team, and he basically tells everybody he's a really good shot. He says, you know, my old unit, they used to call me Delta Mike, like Delta Force Mike, because I was such a great shot. And he's kind of telling everybody this. And another guy on the team, sort of an older guy named Ted McDermott, who everybody calls Mac. And by the way, not all nicknames are that inventive, so he's just Mac. He overhears Delta Mike telling everybody, you know, yeah, I'm Delta Mike. Delta Mike, nice to meet you. He says, what? So your name's not Delta Mike. Your name is Dead Mike. And so forever, he becomes Dead Mike, or just said to his friends. And he learns the first rule, which is you never, ever try to give yourself a nickname. And in the opening of the book, Dickhead Mike meets a somewhat tragic fate, very close to Squirrel, and it really shakes Squirrel up, kind of tears on his conscience, and it causes him to actually sort of turn into a sort of whistleblower, which gets him thrown out of the CIA, and is why when we meet him, he's down on his luck and accepting a job from Sheepdog to go repossess a jet.
Both these characters have been betrayed in some way by the U.S. government or by the U.S. military or by people who have power over them in ways that are unexpected. When we talk about Cheese, you mentioned him working the night shift at a gas station. He also has a really compelling, I brought me to tears, story about visiting Taco Bell. Will you tell a little bit, I don't think that's a spoiler, to tell a little bit about his immigrant experience as this top pilot who has done so much for the United States of America and for his own country, and then he wants to get food.
Well, I think, you know, one of the themes in the book is betrayal. And I don't say this the book is not didactic. It's not trying to tell you what to think. But I think there is always, particularly in war, embedded in it a certain type of betrayal, right? Because fundamentally war, you know, war is the act of state-sanctioned killing. And so, you know, we are asking people to sort of betray parts of their fundamental humanity for the good of the state, you know, whether we believe that or not. So I think, you know, so much of kind of what tears at people who fought in wars is the sense of sort of like a long-term, you know, conflict or internal betrayal. And you certainly, I think, see that with Cheese when you meet him. And so when you meet him, he is... He's working the graveyard ship. He's an immigrant, and I think he feels very betrayed by how the war in Afghanistan ended. That, you know, he's a guy who, if he had been born in the United States, would probably be an astronaut. But he's sort of stuck doing menial labor, with his wife, and he's trying to make ends meet. And so when he works at the gas station, he can't afford to buy the food really in the gas station. It's too expensive for him, and he needs to get a meal on his shift. So he's got 30 minutes off on one shift. So he basically goes, he doesn't have a car. So he runs to the nearest place where he can get cheap food, which is Taco Bell. But when he immigrated from Afghanistan, if you go to many restaurants in Afghanistan or anywhere in the Middle East, the way they operate is like they sell one thing. So if you go to to Adil Shawarma, you order the Adil Shawarma. Or if you go to, you know, Mustafir Falafel, you order the Mustafir Talat Falafel. So he runs down to the Taco Bell, and it's shut. Only the drive-through window's open. He doesn't have a car, so he goes up to the, you know, goes up to the window and orders, you know, what he thinks, you know, you should order at a Taco Bell, which is the Taco Bell. I would like the Taco Bell, please. And they're like, well, we don't know what the Taco Bell is. So it's sort of humiliating for him, and he figures out what the cheapest thing is on the menu, which is the bean and cheese burrito for 89 cents. And so he sustains himself for, you know, a long time by eating bean and cheese burritos. And when he embarks on one of his motivations, when he embarks with Squirrel, says, okay, I agree, I'm going to take the risk. I'll go repossess this jet because I will never again in my life want to taste the taste of a bean and cheese burrito. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's both funny, but I think sort of poignant, you know, you know, gagging on those bean and cheese burritos just to survive.
Yeah. And thematically throughout the book is also this idea of armies last longer than the wars that they are stood up to fight. So that if the U.S. pulls out of Afghanistan, someone like Cheese and all the people who were trained to be together in this fighting force, they might not have anything to do, and they're really highly trained. So they're after the money. They need the money, Squirrel and Cheese do. They're also after meaning and purpose.
Yeah.
And togetherness.
That's right.
They want to do something together again. Yep. Talk about meaning and purpose in the Marine Corps for you and for the other Marines that you led.
Well, that's certainly the case with Squirrel and Cheese. You know, it seems like they're doing this for financial reasons, but, you know, Squirrel, as I mentioned, was sort of fired out of his job at the CIA. And is sort of financially ruined. And he's kind of doing this because he just wants his life back. And Cheese is doing it because he wants to fly again. This is the only, Squirrel is the only person who's given him an opportunity to get back into a cockpit. And that, so both of them, they're craving purpose. You know, and purpose, I think, links to meaning in our lives. And I think, you know, I've seen a lot of, I think veterans will often struggle with this. Sometimes people will ask me about, you know, like, you know, PTSD. Mm. And it's such a broad, it's become such a broad term in our culture. And people, you know, sort of ask me, like, you know, how do I think it's affected at least my generation of veterans? I think, you know, it's interesting. When I look at my generation of veterans, the thing I think most people have struggled with, you know, there is certainly the PTSD that is like very much associated with an event that involves, you know, nightmares, that type of psychological anguish. And what I'm going to say is not to diminish that, because that is a very real thing. But the type of PTSD I've seen that has been much more sort of endemic and widespread, I would define a little bit differently, and is this. I think any person, right, and we can probably all identify with this, to be happy in our life, like, we have to have a sense of purpose, right? So, you know, to give like a very sort of vanilla, you know, just a vanilla plain example of like a person's sense of purpose. Like, so let's say there's a person, right? And that person, they work a job. And that job puts food on the table for their family. They watch their children grow, get a bit of education, have maybe some more opportunities than they had. That probably gives them a sense of purpose. And from that sense of purpose, they derive their happiness. So you could almost say that, like, you know, sort of purpose is the drug that from which we derive happiness. Well, when you join the military, what I've often seen is you at a very young age can develop a sort of dysfunctional relationship with purpose. And what I mean by that is, so let's say you're, you know, 21, 22 years old, and your purpose is not, you know, what I described, putting, you know, food on the table for your family. Your purpose is, you know, you're in Afghanistan and you and your platoon are assigned with holding a, you know, a mountain outpost, or you're in Iraq and you and, you know, your special operations team have to hold these city blocks. So that is like a very, at least at the lower levels, like this very intense and super clear purpose, because you sort of, you know who you are, you know your mission. And oh, by the way, the people you're doing it with will probably be some of the best friends you've ever had in your life. So if I said that, like, purpose is the drug that sort of induces happiness, at that very young age, you are like freebasing the crystal meth of purpose every single day. It is like really intense. And you do that for a long time. In my case, I did it for 8 years. And you do that. But at a certain point, you know, you have to come home. And so, you know, you have to come home. You have to figure out your life. You know, you have to look out there. What am I going to do? Maybe I'm going to go back, use my GI Bill. I'm going to go to college, or maybe I'll sell real estate, or I'll, you know, get a job at Home Depot. You know, but you have to repurpose yourself and find that happiness. But nothing is as intense as what you were doing before. So you, as you repurpose yourself, you look around at the options, and it's not the crystal meth of purpose anymore. It's kind of like the Coors Light beer of purpose. And you realize that a person can realize that, and a certain depression sets in. And I don't know if you want to call that PTSD, you can call it whatever you want to call it, but I've certainly seen that happen. And I think that is something that's a real challenge for veterans. And, but oh, by the way, it's also not exclusive to veterans. I think it's for anyone who's sort of reached the summit of something that's very intense. Reckoning with a descent from that intensity can be extremely difficult.
And in your case, because the war keeps going after you leave, it's not like there's a war, America wins it, we go home. Sure. It's a war, America loses, we go home. We deal with that. In this generation, it's a forever war. And so at some point, after 8 years in your case, after 5 deployments, you have to make the decision to switch your purpose, mm-hmm. which I'm guessing in the enlisted ranks, I mean, that's not as hard, I don't think. I could be wrong about that, but in the officers, because it's a career, there's, you know, there's promotions involved. I guess when I served, most of us were like, hey, we did 6 years. We plan to get out. Are you going to ship over? Are you going to go stay? It didn't seem to have this intense drama, but we also weren't fighting forever wars.
Yeah, I think it's maybe a little different, but I certainly knew a lot of, like, you know, I mean, when I was in the Marine Raiders, my team sergeant, he actually, and you know this, you know, for most enlisted Marines, you know, you do a 20-year career and you get your retirement.
Yeah, well, sure.
And
yeah.
He got out after 16 years, and that was a very, and it was a tough decision because there's always, and as you mentioned, like, there's always one more deployment to go on. So I would often talk with, you know, my friends, you know, across categories, we'd say, you know, we just sort of wish this was like, there was an end and we could all, you know, either like go to business school or, you know, start our next chapter and it was just over for us. But because there was no political peace, each one of us who left sort of had to declare a separate peace for ourselves. And like any peace, you know, some are more long lasting than others. And I think that was really, I'll speak for myself, that was hard. You had to just say like, you guys might be going back out, but I've decided it's over for me. I don't know anyone who hasn't wrestled with that decision.
And you have experience, and you've been in the Battle of Fallujah, you've been in other battles, you've come home again and again, you've brought your Marines home and home and again. Did you feel that if something bad happened at the next deployment and you weren't there,
I certainly felt
would
that.
You have felt guilty
about
that?
I certainly felt that with friends. You know, I mean, I had a very good friend who, you know, was killed 3 years after I left the service. And, you know, I mean, that was when he was killed. It was very hard. And he was killed in 2014. And I remember when he, you know, when that happened, it seemed insane because at that point, we're like, this war has been going on for so long that he would now die in it this many years later seemed just unimaginable. And oh, by the way, there was still 7 years left on the war when he died. So it's been, I think, a challenge to get our heads around that. But you know, every person's situation is different. I've had a lot of these conversations with friends of mine. I have a very good friend who, you know, had a lot of experience in the wars. And he might have gone out, but he was wounded at the end and was sort of forced to get out. And he and I have had conversations about how that was really difficult for him. He's like, you know, even had I made the choice that it was done for me, he's like, Elliot, you were able to make that choice for yourself. He's like, that choice was made for me, and that's been tough for me. Each situation is different, and everyone has to kind of negotiate with themselves how they're going to find their own peace inside.
There's more to this conversation. It's coming up just after this short break. You're in the Moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. Let's get back to Lori's conversation with author, veteran, and journalist Elliot Ackerman.
Squirrel's Girlfriend. Both Squirrel and Cheese have women in their lives. And I think you wrote these characters very effectively as complicated, complex women who have real influence in the story, not just as accessories. So I say that before I reveal to the audience that Siobhan is a dominatrix, essentially.
Yes.
And she is hired to cause pain to men for pleasure. And there is something about that that is helping them feel like they are alive. And I thought you did a really deeply sensitive, funny, tough depiction of the way she is in the world. Now, she's not that way with Squirrel because, of course, he's been through all these things. This is not what he needs. But again, is that about purpose, about people looking for, hey, I survived something?
Right.
Well,
I'll give you sort of Sinead, her sort of throwaway line when she... her throwaway line when she meets Squirrel and they're kind of trying to understand each other and he's sort of trying to understand what she does is she basically says, listen, I help people with their anxieties. You know, I'm basically, you know, like a therapist. The only difference is I don't take health insurance. you know, she basically says we both kick the crap out of people to help them with their anxieties. The therapist, me, I used to do it a little bit differently. And so she's sort of tongue in cheek in that. But I think she and Squirrel, you know, they bond over this fact that they both, Squirrel working in the world of intelligence, and now, you know, coming out of it, into a country that, you know, he doesn't feel understood by. They both are sort of living on the margins of society with what they do, and they both live a little bit of a double life. And so they recognize a counterpoint in one another and, you know, and have, I think, you know, a very real relationship. And the same with, you know, the same with Cheese and his wife, Farida.
Talk a little bit about the business corporation, things that aren't under the purview of the government anymore, but moved into the business side of things and the risks of that, the oversight of that, because that is a big theme of the book.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are thinking about that in America as well. I know it's not overtly tied to, you know, current events, mm-hmm. but I suspect today, 5 years from now, 25 years from now, there will be things in this book that people will say, oh, that's just like this corporation or that corporation or that millionaire or that billionaire.
Yeah, well, there's, I mean, the epigraph of the book is a quote by a Marine general named Smedley Butler, who I imagine most of you haven't heard of him, but if you're sort of part of the cult of the Marine Corps, which we are, he is a large figure. He earned the Medal of Honor twice, has very distinguished career, but and lived sort of at the turn of the 20th century. But at the end of his career was very, very negative on U.S. foreign policy. So the epigraph is, war is a racket, said Smedley Butler. It's run for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the many. And the book, Sheepdogs, it's fun, but it kind of, it analyzes the economies that exist around war. Like, you know, who's profiting from the war? Who's doing well? Why is this going on for so long? How are we accounting for the war? And I think when we look at the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, just as citizens, and people sometimes ask me, you know, what are the lessons we should have learned? For me, the biggest lesson I see as a society that's come out of these wars is how they were fought and why they went on for so long. And what I mean by that is, if you look at like the history of the United States, every war we've ever fought has had needed a construct to sustain it. And what I mean by that is a construct is sort of exists of two things, right? The blood and the treasure of how the war will be sustained. So blood, who's going to fight it? Treasure, how are we going to pay for it? So if we look, you know, let's go back to the Civil War, right? The first ever draft in the United States was during the Civil War. So that was the blood. And the first income tax we ever had came in during the Civil War. If we look at the Second World War, a national mobilization and war bonds, right? In the Vietnam War, the construct was a very unpopular draft, which ultimately led to the end of the war. When we looked at the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, right after September 11th happened, that war that we were all going to war, it needed a construct to sustain it. And so how did we do that? Well, the blood came from our all-volunteer military. And we live in a society today where most people don't serve, and the military is sort of this 1%, and oftentimes sort of a subculture in the United States. And the treasure was, there was never a war tax, it was deficit spending. So we just put it on our national credit card. And the result of that, that was felt by a volunteer military with deficit spending, was that most Americans, if they didn't have a family member serving, were sort of insulated from the costs of the wars. We were anesthetized to them. And the result of that was there's like sort of no political pressure on our leaders to end these wars, because the other ones, Vietnam or even the Civil War, it was so disruptive for our society to be fighting the wars this way. So in our case, because that was the construct, the wars went on and on and on. So I think for any of us, it's sort of this question of like, what is the racket that is at the fundamental base of how the war is being run? Squirrel and Cheese kind of get into that. They get into the internal workings of sort of the CIA, who owns the jet, what's on the jet, where's this money going? I don't want to give too many spoilers, but it kind of touches on some of those themes, not only in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but the wars in Ukraine and how kind of all of these wars feed into a larger economy.
When I was in the Marine Corps, I never knew that about Smedley Butler, he had ever had any kind of change in how he felt war was fought, mm-hmm. and spoke about it. It wasn't until many years later.
I saw
a movie and I was like, wait a minute, is that what Smedley Butler said? And then mm-hmm. I had to go look up his book and learn that. So that was not something that was part of my original.
Yeah, he's
when
a character.
When you're right, it was not part of the original cadence.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's just put it that way.
That's right.
You have written, you mentioned the War Department versus the Department of Defense, and you mentioned a draft. You said it should be the War Department. You wrote that in The Atlantic. I've read where you said there should be a draft and this is what it should look like. Those are not popular American ideals. Why do you think it should be called the War Department, and how should naming it, as we go back to where we started at the top of the hour with why names matter?
Sure. Well, it's funny for my, I guess for my sins of writing that piece, I'm actually, I think in a week or so, I'm going back to my old college and I have to debate this point with a professor. So I'm like, oh geez, watch out what you say. I think for me, and it's not, I'm not much of a partisan when it comes to politics. So it's divorced from any of the things going on with the administration. I think you should just call things what they are. I mean, I think language really matters. And I think anytime we drift away and we try to sort of soften language and use euphemisms to make difficult things sound really easy and cozy, we're actually not doing anybody a service. Like, we should just say what the thing is. Like, if this is a department of the government that exists to fight wars, you know, if maybe if we call it the Defense Department, that's not the best thing, because it makes fuzzy what do these folks actually do, you know, and maybe that's when you lead to things like, well, you know, soldiers are also, they do more peacekeeping missions and they do more diplomatic missions. And so suddenly you wind up with experiences like I had in my wars where, you know, you have like a 20-year-old Marine Lance Corporal who's an infantryman and he is, you know, doing all this diplomatic work. On the one hand, we might say, oh, that's great, you know, that he can, you know, not only just be someone, you know, who carries a rifle, but he can also work with village elders. And yes, it's admirable when they can do that. But what winds up happening is our government is we don't invest in the agencies that should be doing that, like the State Department or USAID. We just hand it to the military, hand it to the guys at the Department of Defense. So I think precision and language, oftentimes, particularly when it comes to war and government, that precision and language gives you precision and outcomes. And I think a precision and outcomes is not something we've had in the U.S. for a while.
Yeah. There is a battle, and again, I don't want to spoil anything in the book, but there's a battle that Squirrel is a part of, which is mentioned in the beginning, but then mm-hmm. becomes, again, a key point throughout the book, that is complicated. Mm-hmm. And it's not simple, and it is difficult for him to live with in the days ahead, and nobody wants to call it what it is. Mm-hmm. And you have been in these battles, and you have... Can you go back to them and rethink them? Do you talk about your Silver Star citation and reading it in another book where you're kind of filling in people like, here's what's happening between the lines, here's what's happening in this moment. What is the role of like of going back, first of all, for you
sure.
personally to go back and rethink about, hey, this is what people have said about me when they pin this on my chest. But yet this is what I remember happening, and that's not going to make it in the citation.
Right.
So I'm going to write it down.
Yeah.
Walk us through that.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's a great sort of quote by Plato, but it's, you know, and I hesitate to quote Plato, but it's, you know, the first casualty of war is the truth. And that's, I think that, you know, and not maliciously, I think that, you know, war is so chaotic that I noticed every time in my military experience, every time I was in a firefight and it finally ended, the first thing I would notice guys do, every time, well, actually, the first thing was usually someone would start smoking a cigarette to try to calm down. But over those cigarettes, guys would start telling, they'd be like, oh, man, you see, you went up there. Yeah, no, and then I went over here. And they would be like desperately telling the story of what happened. Like they needed it because they were, everyone's making sense of this total chaos that just occurred, trying to nail it down into a story and lock it into a story so that we could all collectively understand it and then put some meaning around it. And those stories would lock in, and some of them would be true, and sometimes just wouldn't be true. Not because anyone is lying, it's just because the story would become the thing we all needed. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons I wanted Sheepdogs to be funny was because what can get lost, and I have, you know, I've been around a while now, you know, I have some friends who've passed who, at least in the Marine Corps, have, you know, there's legends around some of these guys. Mm-hmm. And I just remember them how they were. And as much as I love that the legends exist around some of these folks who are my friends and some of my mentors who were, you know, killed in action, there's also this part of me that like, never wants their pathos to disappear, because I remember what boneheads they were when they were alive too, as well as being these heroes, you know what I mean? And so you don't want that pathos to disappear. So I mean, I think what you're talking about, Lori, is I wrote a memoir called Places and Names, which is sort of a mix of reporting from the war in Syria mixed in with recollections from the wars in Iraq. And I wrote this memoir, and at the end of it, I, you know, handed it in to my editor, who read it, and he's like, oh, this is great, you know, we're excited to publish this. And he sat me down, and he took me to lunch, and he sat me down, and he said, we're happy to publish this, we think it's great. He said, listen, I would be really remiss if I didn't tell you that, you know, in this book, you don't write about, you know, this moment that in Fallujah, you know, where the Silver Star was awarded to you, and like, we'll publish it, but, you know, I don't know what, you know, I think it'd be a better book if you figured out a way to write about that. And I didn't totally know how to write about it. And it wasn't like a false modesty thing. I just sort of didn't know a way in that didn't feel like, so there I was, you know, and this was happening, and that was happening. And one of the things I had from that Silver Star is when anyone awards a medal, and I myself, I've written many of these citations for Marines I served alongside. When you send it up the chain of command, there's sort of a one-page little citation that says what the person did, which maybe some of you have seen. But you have to submit a lot more than just this one pager to get someone a big fancy medal. You have to submit something called a summary of action, which is the longest document, which is a multi-page document saying this is exactly what happened. And it almost reads like a witness statement with a lot of detail. And so I had been given my summary of action, and I'd read it over many times. And what always struck me was, yes, this is what happened, but there's so much missing from this. And the language is written in a very sort of specific, stilted military type language. You know, Lieutenant, he did this, then he did that. And so it occurred to me that the way to break that out was to literally just go through this summary of action and annotate it and say, like, yes, this is what was happening in that moment, but this was what this one Marine said to me. This is how this other guy looked at me. And then nobody ever knew that while I was doing this, you know, Opon was across the street and he did that, and no one even did it. So noticed that he did that. And so I wanted to write that in because I think what often just gets lost, and it's one of the reasons I write fundamentally, is those little bits of truth that kind of fall in between the sentences and the story.
Yeah, thank you for that.
We're bringing you Lori Walsh's conversation with author and veteran Elliot Ackerman. The final installment of this interview is up in about 90 seconds. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. We've been spending the hour with Elliot Ackerman. He's shared war stories with us. But he's also dived headfirst into what those stories say about the culture and legacy surrounding America's forever wars.
We talked earlier, before we gathered here tonight, about Tim O'Brien's The Things We Carried, Carmelante's Matterhorn, Kurt Vonnegut, Slaughterhouse-5, and that list could go on and on and on. I want to go to Vonnegut because one of the key things about Slaughterhouse-5 in the very beginning is the wife of his friend saying, you know, if you write this, everybody's just going to, you know, really cool actors, cool sexy actors are going to play you in the movie, and you were just a bunch of children. You were just a bunch of babies. And so throughout Slaughterhouse-5, you see Vonnegut making intentional literary choices to say somebody was being foolish. You know, Billy Pilgrim is always wearing, like, mm-hmm. A little cape or a jacket that's too small for him. They look cartoonish. They do dumb things. They loot. They fall apart. They lose control of their bodily functions. And so I'm wondering, in a book, this is a cool book. Like, this is, mm-hmm. is it already getting made into a show or some kind of on-screen?
Yes, it is, yeah.
Okay, because it should be if it's not. And, well, what's your relationship with the fact that this is going to be something that somebody could romanticize and then is written by this really cool combat veteran Marine, and there's the romance, but also the reality of how difficult and painful this is?
The book is set up at, hopefully coming to Apple. So we're working on it right now. And I think it's to work on it. It's to be involved, you know, and to make sure that the tone is correct and that it doesn't fall, you know, too far one way or the other. And that's something I take pride in my work. I want it to feel real. I want the people who were there to see truth in it. And it's funny, in the book, I mean, because, you know, you go to Hollywood, everything gets reduced into like one sort of sentence. And the way we've pitched the book is, this is SEAL, the TV show SEAL Team meets The Office. And oh, by the way, that's sort of the reality of being in these high-end special operations units. It is. It's like it's SEAL Team. It's incredibly exciting and really cool things are happening. But you cannot get rid of this sort of banality of life and how mundane life is. And it just, because it just is. And the comedy of that. And the fact that, I'm fortunate to have, you know, served with some, you know, really remarkable people in the special operations world. But what makes them so remarkable is not that they were supermen, is that they're just regular guys. doing some pretty remarkable things. But you never want to lose sight of the fact that they're regular guys that squirrel can't spell. You know, that all of their quirks, and so those are very present. So for me, it's just insisting on that at every stage.
Yeah, she just wants to call his wife.
Yeah, he just wants to call his wife.
Can I call his wife? Yeah. I got to call my wife.
Exactly.
The idea of being a writer didn't come to you while you were in. You didn't have a notebook that, you know, after some deployment, you sat and wrote down everything. When did you learn that the two things, that the discipline of being in the Marines turned out to be a really good discipline for being a writer, and two, that writing was a job and that you wanted to do it?
Yeah, well, for me at least, I think writers work in all different ways. I'm sort of like, my wife is also a writer, and she says, like, I'm kind of like a coal miner when I go to my desk. I just sit there and, like, plod away all day until I finally get there. I'm not a guy who, like, sort of walks around waiting for the inspiration to hit me. I'm just sort of, humping out at the computer. So, and that was sort of how I was a Marine. So I think it's good preparation. I got my start. I did not know I wanted to be a writer. I just wanted to be a Marine for years. I did it. But I did get to a certain point where I was like, I think I want to do other things with my life. A few people had encouraged me to write some type of a book. And I came around to that idea. I'd always been a reader. And I had written, I look back now, I'd always written sort of magazine articles. I wrote for the Marine Corps Gazette and things like that. And so the books that I had read that had always meant the most to me about my experience were actually novels, books like Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried or Jim Webb's Fields of Fire. Mm-hmm. Those books meant a lot to me when I was heading into the service and informed my understanding of what the experience would be. And then after I went to war, I reread a lot of those books and understood them in a different way. And so I just sort of had this idea, it's like maybe I could write a novel like that. That seemed like it would be, really great if I could try to achieve that. And I sort of, thought maybe I could write a book that like some future version of my 17-year-old self would read and find some meaning in. So I, sat down and I was working a different job at the time, and I was working sort of early mornings and weekends, and started working through this very close to the bone autobiographical novel. And I finished it. I went out and I got an agent very quickly. That agent, he's still my agent today, he's one of my best friends, was super excited about the book, I'm going to send it to 26 publishers, it's going to be huge. And I was like, I said, this writing books thing is hard, this is easy. and he sent out 26 publishers, and 26 publishers rejected the book. I like to tell that story because I think oftentimes, unlike being an actor or something, writers, when we fail in private. Nobody ever knows about it. But I think sometimes that can be tough on other writers because they just think everyone walks around succeeding all the time, and they don't. And so I sort of picked myself up off the floor. And unfortunately, in that process of writing that book, while I was sort of working another job, I had this sort of horrible realization that I don't wish on any of your children, which is that I wanted to be a writer. So I was like, oh my God, I got to do, I think I actually really want to do this, which also was sort of scary. How am I going to make this work? And so anyways, long story short, I started working on a second book after I finished the first one, and I sold that second book, that became the first book. And so I think, part of being a writer, I've heard of anything in the arts, but writing is showing up every day, is you show up every day, and you don't know the day that breakthrough is going to occur. You're going to figure that thing out. Or you're going to be like, oh my God, of course, Squirrel's Girlfriend is a dominatrix. You know what I mean? but when that happens, that for me is a joy. That's why I like doing what I do. Yeah.
How do you find the camaraderie, the friendship, because it is such an isolating thing?
I have a few really great friends.
Are they writers or are they Marines?
They're both.
They're both.
I have a couple who are good friends who are writers. My wife is a writer. So I think you find your community wherever you do. And I also have lots of friends who aren't writers who do other things, which I think is great.
Yeah. We talked earlier today, and we can skip this story if you just want to talk more about writing, about going back to Fallujah.
Oh, yeah, sure. We're talking about in the context of people who've gone back to Vietnam, and I had the opportunity about 10 years after I fought in the Battle of Fallujah to go there. Esquire magazine sent me, and I had wanted to go back to a specific building where on the second day of the battle, my platoon and I, we found ourselves surrounded. It was a really tough day for us. And I won't bore you, but a whole host of events happened, how we kind of had to break out of the building, and it was a tough day. And so, you know, I didn't know what it would be like. I'd always, you know, heard these stories of, you know, how cathartic it had been for veterans to go back and stand on the places where they fought their battles. And I was, what sort of surprised me, and this maybe gets to the theme of these forever wars, was so I went back. But in 2016, if you remember, Iraq wasn't doing so great. Like ISIS had just come in. Fallujah had about 9 months before, there'd been the third battle of Fallujah, and the Iraqis had kicked ISIS out. So the city was in really bad shape. And I was there, and there was fighting in the north with ISIS. But I went into Fallujah, and I kind of didn't want to tell everybody that I'd fought in the battle. I'd said sort of like showing up in Fallujah and saying you'd fought in the second battle as a Marine was sort of like showing up in New Orleans and saying your name was Hurricane Katrina. Like, you know, it wasn't something you wanted to advertise to everyone because you didn't know how they would react. But the Iraqis I were with quickly like kind of like, why is this American? First of all, why is he even here? And why is he so interested in finding this one place that used to be a kebab shop that, you know, and but I sort of finally found the building where we'd been trapped. And I'd spent a lot of that day kind of crouched on this low wall on a rooftop, sort of trying to coordinate things. And what amazed me was I got up to that rooftop and I looked down. And when we'd broken out of the building that day, my radio operator and I had made it about, I don't know, 10 yards out of the building and then had been pinned down again. Behind just a little, I mean, like a cinder block wall, like our, like maybe a little taller than our stage, just a crumble of cinder blocks. And I sat up there on the roof and I looked down. And I was like, that little crumble of cinder blocks is still there. Like nothing has changed. This place is just frozen in time. Nothing has grown here except the layers of the war that have just kind of come over and over it. So I didn't have that sort of hugely cathartic experience. It was just a reminder of how long wars can go on.
When do you think it's important to tell Americans the truth, and when is it important to spare people the details of the truth?
Well, I think people should always know the truth. Sometimes the truth isn't always just in rubbing people's faces in the details. I mean, sometimes the truth is in, you know, telling people the true story. And I think that the stories we tell as a society is one of the reasons I tell stories, and I guess one of the reasons I probably keep telling stories that, you know, engage with themes of conflict and war. Like, they're really important. You know, I mean, we can look to like foreign affairs right now. If you look in Ukraine, a war I'm you know, I've covered, so I think about it a lot. Anytime Vladimir Putin is interviewed about Ukraine, the first thing he wants to do is give everybody a 3-hour lesson on the history of Ukraine's history vis-a-vis Russia. And the reason he does that is because he's trying to seize the story and say, this is actually the story and this is why we're right and they're wrong. And that pertains to our own country too. Like for instance, people have sometimes asked me, because I'm part of that generation, like, Elliot, like, where were you on 9/11? And I can tell you where I was on 9/11. I mean, I was a college student. But for me, what's always been more germane was not where I was at on 9/11. It's where I was on September 9th, 2001, that I really remember, which was a Sunday night. My brother was my roommate in college, and I had requisitioned the TV in our little common room, because I really wanted to watch a show that was premiering on HBO that night. And that night, 2 days before 9/11, was the premiere of the TV show Band of Brothers. So why does that matter? I love Band of Brothers, I think it's a great show. But if you wanna understand sort of the zeitgeist in America 2 days before 9/11, I think you can look at a show of Band of Brothers, because what does Hollywood do? Hollywood's trying to kind of capture the national mood. And it was a national mood where we were feeling a lot of nostalgia for the Second World War. And we were telling ourselves, you know, stories about the conflicts where there'd been a very clear bad guy and a good guy. We as a country had been the good guys. We had been the liberators. And that was the war we were telling ourselves right when 9/11 happens. So is it any surprise that as America marches off to war again, that is sort of our national narrative. We're going to liberate these countries. You know, there's good guys. We're the good guys. These are the bad guys. And I would argue that particularly as it pertained to Iraq, where we sort of thought we would march in, you know, invade Baghdad, democracy would flourish everywhere, that story, you know, led in many ways to the sort of, you know, the ill-fated mission that was the Iraq War.
The book is called Sheepdogs. It is smart, funny. It is a page-turner, more in the series, I'm guessing, yes, because these characters are definitely ready to tell another story. And I appreciate you being here to tell us part of it.
From all of us at SDPB, thank you for listening.